Welcome to the Fremantle Press podcast. I'm Georgia Richter, publisher of poetry at Fremantle Press, and this podcast is coming to you from Wallyalup in Whadjuk Boodja. Today, I'm really excited that we're here to talk to Prema Arasu, whose book Vampire Squid is out in January 2026. Prema Arasu is a writer and researcher. They have an MLit from the University of St Andrews and a PhD in creative writing from the University of Western Australia. Prema is the author and editor of The Book of Sea Monsters, Leviathans of Literature, which is out with Bloomsbury. Vampire Squid is their first book of poetry. So Prema, welcome. Am I right in thinking that even the genre of poetry is quite new for you?
Yeah, I wrote these poems over the course of a three-year postdoc at the Mindaroo UWA Deep Sea Research Centre. My job there as a postdoc fellow was to research people's perceptions of the deep sea through creative writing and critical writing through publishing academic papers, but I also had a lot of freedom to find and define my own creative projects. My PhD was in fantasy, and I wrote a novel. And I had previously written short stories, and I wrote a few short stories about the deep sea. But as I continued to research the deep sea and people's perceptions towards it, I found that it was this problem of a construction of fear and alterity and the way in which it's represented in popular and scientific culture as mysterious and creepy. In academic work, this is the field of aesthetics, how we feel towards an environment affects how we construct it and how we perceive it, which goes on to affect real life decisions about policy and conservation. So I found myself drawn to poetry as a mode of exploring that aesthetic subjectivity, because poetry is so intimately connected with aesthetics and focusing on the subjective experience of the individual, which was really interesting because it's the complete opposite of scientific objectivity. And a lot of my poems do reflect on that difference there. So I did take steps to formally learn poetry, especially engaging with the history of romantic lyric poetry, where the idea of aesthetics and the sublime really are explored intimately. This book of poetry is a collection of all those poems I wrote. It features the people I work with who are named by their field of study to sort of avoid identifying them, but also to allow me to explore how they see the deep sea in their different ways as well.
And I love the way that, in effect, you're bringing each of those scientists under the microscope, and the scrutiny is as much on them as what they're seeing. Did you have any kind of background in deep sea science before you came to do this research? And because I'm wondering, you know, what it is that you see when you walk in the door at the centre, and whether you came wanting to explore more of that or how that came about.
Yes, so I've done extensive undergrad work in biology. So I did have the science backing to help me kind of interpret and work at the centre, which I think comes across in some of the poems. But in terms of what the Deep Sea Centre actually looks like, it's a building at the back of the university. It's an office building. And there are maybe 20 to 25 scientists who really work there. And in addition to that, at any given time, a good percentage of everyone is at sea on the research vessel Dagon, which is owned by our sponsor company Inkfish. So I have a poem which is early up in Vampire Squid called There Is Nothing Green in the Deep Sea, which is about all the plants we have in the office, because it's in the botany building and we have a lot of plants, but the thing about the deep sea is that there's no plant life at all beyond where light can reach. So I have always felt that the amount of plants, the amount of life we try to have at the physical centre, which is really just a kind of rabbit warren of office buildings, is somewhat of a compensation for that green we lose. So I'll read that now. The centre is buried way down the back of the university. past the concert hall, past the library, past the cricket field, past the Tav, through some innocuous car parks and deep into the Botany building. In the hallway, above a cabinet filled with dead amphipods, is a plant, I don't know its name, that thrives on artificial light. In the deep sea, beyond the reach of sunlight, there are animals, fungi, bacteria that synthesize their own food, nothing with chlorophyll. The ecologist had 10 plants in his sunlit office, leggy succulents soil-studded with gem-like baby propagations. The lab manager, invertebrate zoologist, and molecular ecologist have 7 from the plant sale. The oceanographer and the coastal ecologist have 3 big plants, a monstera, a peace lily, and a long pothos. The analysts have 9, ferns constantly on the cusp of death. The geneticist prefers jars of dead things, king protea, dried gum leaves, and coral skeletons. We each promise to water each other's plants while the others are at sea, where there are none. Sometimes they survive.
Thanks, Prema. I feel like inviting you in to look at our office with fresh eyes. I think we would be surprised at the things that you see. Can you tell me a bit too about how you've structured the collection? Because I love the metaphor that that creates.
Yeah, so for just a bit of background information, the ocean is divided into 5 vertical depths. So first we have sunlight, which is 0 to 200 meters, then twilight, which is up to 1,000 meters, and the deep sea starts at 2,000, so twilight is the first bit of the deep sea. Then we have the midnight zone, 1,000 to 4,000 meters, and then the abyss, 4,000 to 6,000, and then the Hadal trenches, which is 6,000 to the maximum depth of the sea at 11 kilometers deep. So I've structured my 5 parts of Vampire Squid in accordance to those 5 vertical delineations of the deep sea and leaned into what I feel is the vibe for each. So sunlight has a lot of coastal poetry. It has a lot of brightly lit, humorous poetry, and they get a bit weirder as you go deeper. When the poems are about a specific animal or about a specific piece of science, I've tried to situate it in the depth that it is associated with as well. That being said, I'm very conscious of the fact that, and this is a line that runs throughout the book of poetry, that these delineations are human constructs, they're scientific constructs, they are a mode of understanding we as humans have layered on top of a more chaotic reality. And I found that scientists even are very aware of that. So during my time as a researcher at the Deep Sea Centre, I actually co-authored a paper challenging some of the reasons for this vertical division of the deep sea.
They may be scientific delineations, but metaphorically, they also assume their own kind of meaning. And I think on the level of poetry, then you're getting to have it both ways.
Yeah, I am. I'm playing around with the associations and challenging them, sometimes leaning into them, but often challenging them.
It would be fantastic to hear some poems from you. Could we actually start with a vampire squid poem, since that's the title of the book itself?
Yeah, so this poem is very special to me. This is Vampire Squid, Part 1. Does the vampire squid ever worry that she is not enough of a squid? Does she feel alone in the order Vampyra Morphida? Does she feel guilty for creating extra work for taxonomists who have enough problems with cryptic mollusks? Is she ashamed by the filaments on her arms that refuse her from the Octopoda and the Toothida? Does the vampire squid ever worry that she is not enough of a vampire? Is she anxious about appropriating the aesthetics of a subculture to which she does not have any claim? Is she repulsed by her own coprophagic tendencies, wishing instead she enjoyed the taste of blood? Does the vampire squid ever worry that she is not good enough for the deep sea? Does the vampire squid ever worry that she does not belong in the ocean? Does the vampire squid ever worry that she does not belong anywhere?
Thank you, Prema. I love the rhetorical thrust of that one and how it's actually a grab bag of human anxieties and concerns. Do you want to talk to me a bit about the vampire squid and how that creature came to be the title of your collection?
Yeah, to me this was a very clear choice, I think, because the vampire squid is probably the most personal I get in terms of talking about myself, and I'm most comfortable doing that through metaphor. The vampire squid is not an octopus and not a squid. It's something in between. And I myself sort of have an affinity for that in-betweenness. Its scientific name is Vampyrotuthis infernalis, which means vampire squid from hell. And it was named this because its mantle looks like a red cloak. It's this deep, it's beautiful, this deep, deep blood red color. And that is because red light filters out in the deep sea. So it's a way of essentially being invisible. It's a very vulnerable creature. It sounds scary, but it just eats marine snow using its filaments. And it's quite a passive feeding process. So it's not an aggressive creature. It, in fact, has a lot of defense mechanisms where it sprays ink and jets away very quickly. And because it has, it's in between squid and octopus in that way, I'm particularly fascinated with it. It's an elusive animal. One specimen was displayed live at Monterey Bay Aquarium for a few months, but that's the extent to which we've had been able to observe them. The only other observations have been remote.
And it's really worth Googling the vampire squid because they are so extraordinary and so beautiful.
They are beautiful, yeah. But I think the name tends to deter people or maybe misrepresent it, where they are just really little cute little blobs that are quite skittish.
But I also love the way that there's this anthropomorphism at play, which you are both kind of resisting, playing with and investing in things that also have little care or concern for the human world. And I think that tension runs throughout the collection as well in a really effective way.
Yes, that's why it was very clear to me that that was the titular poem of the collection, because it is so personal and deals with all the issues that I think sum up what I was trying to achieve in a quite neat way.
Now, I wonder if you could read to us your very excellent prose poem, Anglerfish Podcast.
Yes, so I decided I really wanted to read this because we are on a podcast and podcasts are having such a cultural moment right now. And there's this phenomenon of, I would say, like a rise of conservatism we're seeing in podcasts and podcast culture. It's giving certain groups a voice. I'll just go ahead and read it. If there are really good fish out there in the sea, where are they? I'm a high value woman. I have my own lure, hunt for myself, take care of all my own needs. Why is it so hard to find a good man with whom I can merge my circulatory system? Men these days just aren't ready to commit. I'm a ride or die kind of girl boss, and if you give me your sperm, you might literally die. But monogamy in this economy, girly pop, don't even. If I find a fertile man in the dating dead zone that is the abysso-pelagic, I'm holding on to him for life, even if I already have 5 or 6 guys already fused to my body and feeding off the nutrients in my blood. It's a numbers game, sexual marketplace theory, and we're all obligated by evolution to play. It's rough out there, queens, so look out for yourself because nobody else is going to.
That anglerfish is such an eye roller, Primo. I would love to see them host their own podcast. What is it about the anglerfish that you're describing there?
So anglerfish are an absolutely fascinating type of fish. So they show an extreme amount of sexual dimorphism, which means a huge difference between the male and the female of the species. So the female is a big fish. The male is tiny and is basically a little sack of sperm with a giant nose whose purpose in life is to smell out a female and then attach to her permanently, merge his circulatory system with hers so he lives off her blood and nutrients, doesn't have to eat for himself or anything, and donate sperm when she wants it. And anglerfish can sometimes have multiple men attached to her at any time. So there have been specimens that have been dredged up, female specimens with, you know, 6 or 7 men attached to her, and she just takes whoever's sperm she wants the best. It's an ideal situation, really.
An anglerfish dating podcast is what you're proposing, I imagine?
Yeah, that system just really resonated with me with all the sexual marketplace theory and dating podcasts that seem to be a big thing at the moment. She's a girl boss.
And it actually makes me wonder, the scientists that you've worked with, how are they receiving this poetry and these creatures that they're studying when seen through your eyes. Have they read your poems?
Yeah, they have. I think it's been a fascinating process. A lot of them, I think, are a bit surprised by the humor present in my poem. I've done a few presentations and a lot of them were just laughing the whole time because they spend a lot of time approaching these creatures in very formulaic, sometimes dry, sometimes honestly a bit tedious settings in that they're watching hours and hours of video footage, counting things, putting things on a spreadsheet. And it's a new thing to see the notion of subjectivity embraced, to see the sort of mundane office environment represented, and to see individuals be worthy of, you know, representation in art and research. So I think it's been quite unique. It hasn't been an entirely straightforward process, so I have had to check very carefully with everyone that they're 100% comfortable with how I've represented them, how I've written them, the level of how identifiable they are if one were to do their research and so on. So it was an ethical process for as much as I could manage as well.
Mm. And I love sometimes in some of your poems how they actually go off campus and there are Friday night drinks and whatever else. So, yeah. So you really are observing their world. I wonder if seeing you as a poet observer, almost a citizen scientist of them, and seeing what you've done and the humour that does flow into that is in some ways freeing for them and how they think about their own work.
I hope so. Yeah, that was one of my major goals. And I think I have been an observer, but I've also felt really welcomed and part of the team. So I don't see myself as someone outside observing in, although I will say that sometimes those anxieties of being in that position are, of course, expressed in my poems, especially the vampire squid poems. But I was treated very much like any other postdoc at the centre in that I was on the same pay grade. I was expected to produce the same amount of research. I attended all the meetings. And I think that really helped because it was very unique, but it made me part of the team in a way that, say, an artist in residence wouldn't be.
Mm, that's very interesting to think about and the way that you are integral to that process. I find that really heartening to hear. Another poem which I think collects up all the scientists that you work with is Wet Ontologies. And I wonder if you could read that one for us too.
Yeah. The oceanographer knows water, how it moves lethargic when compressed under the weight of itself. She knows water as it renders itself as raw data. She is always hydrated. The molecular ecologist knows water. She dredges it from the depths and, on deck, sections it into vials. Later, strands of genetic material are spun into spreadsheets. The marine biologist knows water. He cycles past the river on his way to work, stares at a screen filled with water, more interested in his crinoids and the rocks to which they cling. The geoscientist knows water, the thing between himself and the shape of the seafloor, a medium for his acoustics. On Saturdays, he takes his son swimming. The geneticist knows water, necessary for life, but her subjects are dead. They are placed in jars of ethanol to prevent degradation, where somehow they are even less alive.
It's so obvious to say, but your collection is not only about creatures, but it is about the water in which they lived. I wonder what you think that a poet can do, perhaps, that a scientist cannot when thinking about the world around us?
I think it's that trust of subjectivity. So scientists are always taught that research has to come out of objectivity, which means removing your voice from your writing, removing other factors which impede your data collection or skew your results. But embracing that subjectivity can be really effective in communication, but also research itself. It can be useful in assessing how people perceive your environment, perceive your research, and it can sort of get you out of your bubble, I think.
Mm. You also observe them outside their workplace and their relationship to water there, and I think that captures exactly what you just describe in the the power of poetry and what it can do.
Yeah, the pattern of the poem was just five people I work with and how they engage with water at work and outside of work. So swimming, going past the river. And I wanted to have a particularly Perth aspect of that as well, because I think in WA we have a particular relationship with water, whether that's a culture of everyone learning to swim, going to the beach, cycling past the river, and so on.
And I cannot wait for readers to get their paws onto your poems, because I think they're just magnificent. And it's so delightful to have so much humour threaded throughout as well. It's been a treat to have you read for us today.
Thank you. I'm glad the humour is appreciated. It kind of, yeah, just came along with my writing style.
We've been listening to Prema Arasu reading poetry from their work Vampire Squid, which will be out in January 2026. Prema will be touring and presenting on their book, thanks to the inaugural Forest Foundation Author Fellowship. So watch the Fremantle Press website, fremantlepress.com.au, for more details. And thank you for listening.